It is so good to be with you this morning and to see so many faces here with us, faces that we have not seen in quite some time, new faces that are guests among our assembly. Thank you so much for being here today. We hope that God has been glorified by everything that we've done together and that you have been built up, that you have been encouraged in your faith. I invite you to join me in Mark chapter 15. I want to begin by reading together the first five verses. Mark chapter 15, beginning in verse number 1. Mark 15, verse number 1. As soon as it was morning, having held a meeting with the elders, scribes, and the whole Sanhedrin, the chief priests tied Jesus up, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. So Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered him, "You say so." And the chief priests accused him of many things, but Pilate questioned him again, "Aren't you going to answer? Look at how many things they are accusing you of." But Jesus did not answer still, and Pilate was amazed. Our opening text this morning probably comes out of left field, considering where our studies in Mark left off last week. Let's remember that we were smack dab in the middle of Argument Tuesday, and we had just seen Jesus answer three tough questions in a very brilliant manner, a manner that left those who asked those questions amazed, speechless, and even impressed. Things seem to be going pretty good for Jesus. He seems to be answering all these tough questions well. And yet, when we pick up today, we see that he has now been detained. He's been accused. And he's been led away to Pilate. My question is, how do we get there? How do we go from what we see in chapter 12 to what we see here in chapter 15? Unfortunately, we all know that the calendar is undefeated. We do not get to add any days. And we don't get to take any away. And time simply is not going to allow us to thoroughly study through these last sections of Mark's gospel. So just a quick recap to catch us up from where we were in chapter 12 to where we are today in chapter 15. Remember that Tuesday concludes with a doozy as Jesus renders a strong judgment against the scribes. And then he turns right around and offers up a wonderful and loving heaping of praise upon the poor widow who gave so generously to the temple. And then we see the prediction of the ending of the Jewish system there in Mark chapter 13. And the following day, based upon everything that happens on Tuesday, as Jesus answers all these questions so well, and based upon him going back and rendering another judgment against the Jews and Jerusalem and their system, the chief priests and the scribes, they've had enough. And they're to the point now where they're not just wanting to discredit Jesus, but they're actually wanting to kill Jesus. And the beginning of chapter 14 gives us the way they intend to do it, through the betrayal of one of Jesus' own apostles, Judas. That brings us to Thursday, where Jesus does as any good faithful Jewish man would do. He prepares to observe the Passover, and he wants to do so with his disciples. He is anticipating. That's why it's happening on Tuesday. There's great anticipation that is happening on that Thursday. Great anticipation as he knows what is about to take place, and he's going to tell his disciples about it. He offers a series of predictions and declarations where he says, "Well, one of you will betray me," as Chris read for us earlier. He also speaks of the significance of the meal and the memorial sense that it will carry going forward. But he also speaks about the scattering of his disciples when all this goes down. And from there, the disciples and Jesus go to Gethsemane, where he prays for the Father to strengthen him as he endures what he is about to endure. And we see that prayer being so timely because it isn't but just a moment later that he is betrayed, that he is arrested, taken before the Sanhedrin, beaten, and eventually taken to Pilate in the morning. And that brings us to the early morning of Friday, what we just read together. Pilate would normally be in Caesarea. That's where his home base was. But because the Passover was such a grand feast among the Jewish people in Jerusalem, he felt the need to be there in Jerusalem just to kind of keep an eye on things. That allows the chief priests and the scribes then to take Jesus to him. and to ask him to offer up a judgment concerning Jesus. All sorts of accusations are thrown at him, but to Pilate's amazement, Jesus remains silent. He only offers up the, "Will you say so?" concerning him being the king of the Jews. And that leads us to our text for today, which is Mark chapter 15 and verse 6 through chapter 16 and verse 8, where Jesus, God's servant, finishes the work he was sent by the Father to accomplish. Let's read the text together, beginning in Mark 15 and verse number 6. Mark 15, verse number 6, "At the festival, Pilate used to release for the people a prisoner whom they requested. And there was one named Barabbas who was in the prison with rebels who had committed murder during the rebellion. And the crowd came up and began to ask Pilate to do for them as was his custom. And Pilate answered them, 'Do you want me to release the king of the Jews for you?' For he knew," verse 10, "for he knew it was because of envy that the chief priests had handed him over. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd so that he would release Barabbas to them instead. Pilate asked them again, 'Then what do you want me to do with the one you call the king of the Jews?' Again they shouted, 'Crucify him!' Pilate said to them, 'Why? What has he done wrong?' But they shouted all the more, 'Crucify him!' And wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to them. And after having Jesus flogged, he handed him over to be crucified. The soldiers led him away into the palace, that is the governor's residence, and called the whole company together. They dressed him in a purple robe, twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on him, and they began to salute him, 'Hail, King of the Jews!' They were hitting him on the head with a stick and spitting on him, and getting down on their knees, they were paying him homage. And after they had mocked him, they stripped him of the purple robe and put his clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. And they forced a man coming in from the country who was passing by to carry Jesus' cross. He was Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus. They brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means place of the skull. And they tried to give him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And then they crucified him. And they divided his clothes, casting lots for them to decide what each will get. Now when it was 9 a.m, when they crucified him, the inscription of the charge written against him was, 'The King of the Jews.' They crucified two criminals with him, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by were yelling insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, 'Ha! The one who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself by coming down from the cross.' And in the same way, the chief priests and the scribes were mocking him among themselves and saying, 'He saved others, but he cannot save himself. Let the Messiah, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross so that we may see and believe.' And even those who were crucified with him taunted him. When it was noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m. And at 3, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, 'Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani,' which is translated, 'My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?' And when some of those standing there heard this, they said, 'See, he's calling for Elijah.' And someone ran up and filled a sponge with sour wine, fixed it on a stick, offered him a drink, and said, 'Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down.' And Jesus let out a loud cry and breathed his last. And then the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who was standing opposite him saw the way he breathed his last, he said, 'Truly, truly this was the Son of God.' And there were also women watching from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the younger, and of Joseph and Salome. In Galilee, these women followed him and took care of him, and many other women had come with him to Jerusalem. Yet when it was already evening, because it was the day of preparation, that is the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent member of the Sanhedrin, who was himself looking to the kingdom of God, came and boldly went to Pilate and asked for Jesus' body. But Pilate was surprised that he was already dead. Summoning the centurion, he asked whether he had already died. And when he found out from the centurion, he gave the corpse to Joseph. And after he bought some linen cloth, Joseph took him down, wrapped him in the linen, and then he laid him in the tomb, cut out of the rock, and rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of Joseph were watching where he was laid. And when the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they could go and anoint him. Fairly early in the morning on the first day of the week, they went to the tomb at sunrise. They were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone from the entrance of the tomb for us?" But looking up, they noticed that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. And when they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. "But don't be alarmed," he told them. "You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they put him. But go to his disciples and Peter. He is going ahead of you to Galilee. You will see him there, just as he told you." They went out and ran from the tomb, because trembling and astonishment overwhelmed them, and they said nothing to anyone, since they were afraid. As we look at this text, we realize, and considering what we read at the opening of the lesson, that Jesus has been brought to the person who has the ability to have him executed. The Jews themselves had no ability to execute capital punishment under the rule of Rome. So they had to take him to someone who could accomplish that. That would be Pilate. Yet what we notice in this text is that Pilate really tries to negotiate for Jesus' release, though he fails. Pilate fails to negotiate for Jesus' release. And I say that based on what we see in verse 10. I believe verse 10 is vitally important because it shows us that Pilate is on to the nefarious motivations of the chief priest. He understands that they had brought Jesus to him simply because they were envious of him. And this was a way to get rid of one of their opponents, which is why Pilate tries to use this tradition that he had of the Passover releasing a prisoner to them. Now, why Pilate did this, we don't know for certain. Maybe he was aware of the background of the Passover, and he understood the merciful aspect of the Passover, that the Jewish people were saved from death based upon the grace of God. And maybe he's doing this as a hat tip to that, to gain some favor with the Jewish people. We don't know for certain. Maybe that's what he's doing here. But we do know that's what he did. And here we have a very simple choice. Who to release to the Jewish people? Would you rather have Jesus released, who was known in the Jewish community as being a man of God, as being someone who was blameless, being someone who was as close to a prophet as there could have been? Or would you like for me to release this Barabbas, who was a rebellious murderer? For us, the choice, is that really a choice? Is there really a decision to be made here in this moment? And of course, the answer is no. There's not a real choice to be made here. The choice is simple. And yet we see the chief priests not giving up, don't we? We see them not giving up. They understand that this is an easy choice. So what are they going to do? They're going to go throughout the crowd, and they're going to begin stirring up the people. They're going to begin stirring up the people and pitting them against Jesus, so much so that they're actually crying for Barabbas to be released to them. And Pilate can't believe what he hears. We see that in verse number 14. Why? Why would I release Barabbas? Why would I crucify this Jesus? What has he done? And notice there's no explanation from the crowd. Do we see that? There's no explanation. There's no accusation that they give back to Pilate. They simply stay on, crucify him. Crucify him. And Pilate, being a Roman official, there was one thing that Rome valued above all else within the communities that they ruled over and the areas they ruled over, and that was peace. They wanted peace. They did not want uprisings. They did not want rebellions. They did not want insurrections. All they cared about was keeping the peace. Which again, go to Barabbas. He was part of an insurrection. That's why he was there. So in order for Pilate then to keep the peace, to satisfy the people so that there was not a riot, he does what is very much counterintuitive. He releases to the people the one who is truly deserving of death. And he holds on to Jesus and sends him away to be crucified. The bloodthirst of the people at this point is raging. And Pilate knows that he's at a tipping point. And he asks what's best for Rome. Thus he keeps the peace. And what this leads to then is Jesus enduring horrific abuse prior to the cross. The Romans had perfected. They were absolute professionals when it came to negative reinforcement through the means of the crucifixion process. They were masters of behavioral deferment through putting up examples of this is what happens whenever you cross Rome. Whenever you go against Rome, whenever you cause issues within Rome, this is what you can expect. And yet Jesus isn't even there yet, is he? He's not even to the cross yet, and we see him enduring incredibly unbelievable pain in our minds. Not just the physical pain with the floggings and the hitting with a stick, but also think about the emotional and mental anguish that he is going through here in this moment as he is mocked. A robe was put on him. The crown of thorns is put on him. The spitting is put on him. The false homage is heaped upon him. Think about here in this moment what is going on. We have here in the form of a human God who is responsible not just for the creation of those who surround him, but also for the sustaining of those who surround him. And not only that, but he is also enduring this for their sake. The bodily pain was enough as it was. But the emotional and the mental weight of what Jesus was enduring is truly heartbreaking. Thus, it shouldn't surprise us as they leave the governor's residence and they begin to make their way to the place of the skull, Golgotha. It was the practice for the Roman soldiers to force those who were to be crucified to carry the cross. And yet we notice here in this moment that Jesus literally can't. He can't. What he has endured up to this moment rendered him incapable of carrying his cross. Thus the Roman soldiers, based upon the authority they had to basically tell a Jew to do whatever they wanted a Jew to do, they grabbed this man from Cyrene, his name was Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. I want us to note here how specific Mark is, that this was Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander Rufus. I believe that is there because these people who were receiving this letter, they knew Alexander Rufus. I see no other reason for them to be mentioned here than for this being somebody that they were an acquaintance of, that they can go and they can talk to this Alexander Rufus and they can talk to them and ask them questions about what was it like for your dad to carry Jesus' cross. Maybe based upon what happened here, Simon himself became a disciple. Again, let's notice that these seemingly random, strange, out of nowhere facts that Mark gives us, that they're purposeful. I believe that's why that's here in this moment. Simon carries his cross to Golgotha. Jesus goes there. And I want to note verse 24, the beginning of verse 24, three words. They crucified him. They crucified him. Do you notice the lack of detail in this gospel account? I believe that's here because those who Mark is writing to, they know what crucifixion was all about. They did not need it explained how Jesus was hung on the cross. They didn't need that explained. They were well versed with what crucifixion was. And therefore, Mark just gives that very simply stated, though we know that there was so much more that went into what happened to Jesus here than simply those three words. Yet that's followed up by a couple of things that took place at the crucifixion that fulfilled prophecy. Jesus' garments being divided up was a prophecy fulfilled from Psalm 22 and verse 18. The fact that he was crucified between criminals can be found in Isaiah 53 and verse 12. Yet everything we've seen up to this point, the physical pain, the mental and emotional abuse, that might only be topped from the perspective of other people based upon the shame and the embarrassment that Jesus would have been enduring at this point going forward. That there he hung, his body bare on a cross, bloodied, beaten, flesh filleted. And as people walked by, Mark tells us that they yelled insults at him. That they mocked him. That they said, oh, there's that one right there. There's that one who said he's going to destroy the temple in 3 days and raise it up. And yet there he is himself helpless. There he is himself hopeless. He said he can do these incredible things. Well, he can't even bring himself down from a cross. And what's going on here was purposeful, wasn't it? Again, the Romans were masters of negative enforcement. They're going to show you this is what happens whenever you go against us. As they're walking into Jerusalem, as they're going along the main thoroughfare, there is these men hanging on a cross and they're thinking, oh, I don't want to end up there. I don't want to be up there next. I better make sure I mind my P's and Q's that I don't go against Rome. Yet we all know why Jesus is there, right? It's not because he had gone against Rome. It's not because he had behaved in an inappropriate way. It wasn't because he had committed a crime. No, he's there because the envy of the chief priests, which is why they're sitting back and they're mocking. Ha, he said he's the Messiah. He said he's the Messiah, yet here he is, this King of Israel. He's not even able to bring himself down from the cross. And what do they say? This just burns me up. I'll be honest with you. This burns me up. I wish he would bring him down from the cross, they said. That way we could see and believe. Yeah, right. Even him coming down from the cross wouldn't have done anything for them. They had eyes that could not see, ears that could not hear, hearts that were hard as a rock. Nothing was going to penetrate them. Nothing was going to bring them to belief in this moment. And yet here they are mocking him. And not only them, but even the criminals under the same sort of condemnation, they are even taunting. They're even taunting Jesus. And that brings us to the noon hour where there is great darkness that takes place until the death of Jesus. For 3 hours there is darkness that covered the whole land, and surely we understand there's great symbolism that is going on here. Maybe this was done in the form of the ninth plague of darkness that led up to the Passover in Egypt. Maybe it's done for that reason. Or maybe it's done as a symbolic understanding of just how heinous this action was, the fact that God was being killed by his creation. Whatever the intended message, whatever the intended symbolism, what took place along with that, it truly made an impression on at least one person. And we'll talk about him in just a moment. But it's at this moment that Jesus cries out with a loud voice, the quotation that we said earlier, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is translated, my God, why have you abandoned me? And there have been untold number of theories as to what Jesus meant when he said these words. But I think really it's simple whenever we consider the quotation itself from Psalm 22. Psalm 22 is a psalm of David. And the king in that psalm presents at the beginning of that psalm a person who truly believes, based upon his current circumstances, that he has been abandoned by God, that God has forsaken him, and that God is not going to provide for him, God is not going to be with him. And that's the way the entire psalm sets up until you get to Psalm 22 and verse number 24. In Psalm 22 and verse number 24, actually in verse 21, we see the one who is speaking in the psalm, saying as he's crying out to God, as he's pouring his heart out before God in this horrible situation, in whatever circumstance he's in, he says, "You did answer me." And because of that, verse 22, "I will proclaim your name to my brothers and sisters. I will praise you in the assembly. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All the descendants of Jacob, honor him. All you descendants of Israel, revere him. For he has not despised or abhorred the torment of the oppressed. He did not hide his face from him, but listened when he cried out to him for help." This is what's going on here on the cross, brothers and sisters. From everybody's perspective, this man is cursed. From everyone's perspective, this man, Jesus of Nazareth, has been abandoned on the cross. His disciples are not there. He is going through this all alone. He says he's a man of God, but here is this man who claims to be this great servant of God enduring this horrible punishment. Yet he quotes Psalm 22. And what does Psalm 22 tell us? Brothers and sisters, it tells us that looks can be deceiving. Looks can be deceiving. Though from everybody else's perspective, though from the normal eye, it seems as if this man has been abandoned, what Jesus is helping them to understand here in this moment, if they have eyes that can see and ears that can hear, if they have a heart to receive it, here he's letting them know, it might look bad, but my God is with me. This might look bad, but this is being done because I am committed to God. It might look bad, but I am glorifying my Father here in this moment. Your eyes deceive you if you believe I am truly rejected. My God is with me. And with him breathing his last, we see the veil of the temple being torn. Now, of course, this is the first time we've seen something torn into within Mark's gospel, is it? Go back to chapter 1 and verse number 10. The sky, upon Jesus being baptized, the sky was torn open, and he heard the voice of his Father, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." What does it mean when this veil's torn in the temple? Whenever this curtain is torn? Maybe that's what's being said here. Maybe this is a proclamation of God, of what he just claimed himself. From Psalm 22, yes, I am with you. Yes, I do approve of what you're doing. Yes, you are bringing me honor and glory. But there's also the powerful symbolism of the fact that we now have access to God in a way that we've never had before. That curtain was there to separate the regular room in the temple from the holy place, then the holy place from the most holy place. And now with that curtain being ripped, access has been granted. In a wonderful way through Jesus, a way that was not made possible under the law. And as I mentioned earlier, there was at least one person here who got what was going on. And we might think it might have been one of the chief priests, might have been one of the scribes, might have been one of the Jewish leaders who were there, might even be one of his disciples that were there, that the light bulb clicked and he said, "Ah, I get it now." But no, it was a Roman. It was a centurion. He is the one that proclaimed truly this man was the Son of God. And haven't we seen that all throughout Mark's gospel? Haven't we seen that all throughout this study, that those who are the closest to the truth, they could not see the truth because of those eyes and because of those ears and because of those hearts. Yet here is this man who's just sitting here, who has really no pony in the race. He has no dog in the fight. He's just doing his job. But he sees everything that's going on. He sees the way that this man is taking the punishment. He sees the way the darkness has come over. He heard what he said. He saw the way he breathed his last. He's like, "Hey, I think we might have just really messed up." Brothers and sisters, that shows the power of truth for those who are willing to take the data, to take the evidence, and simply consider it to come to a conclusion. And the conclusion in this moment was that the Son of God had been killed, and his body hung on a cross, which gave opportunity for another man, a man that we might not be expecting to come onto the scene, a man belonging to the Sanhedrin of all groups, The ones who had brought Jesus to this point, he comes and he wants Jesus' body. He wants to show respect for him. He was somebody who was expecting the kingdom of God, and it seems to be that this Joseph of Arimathea, he made a connection between the kingdom of God and Jesus. That seems to be what's happening here. And therefore, he boldly goes to Pilate, and he says, "Can I have Jesus' body?" And Pilate, in his moment, is surprised. He's surprised Jesus is already dead. Because after all, Romans designed crucifixion to be a drug-out process to really drive home the point, you don't want to do this. Yet Jesus was already expired. And the fact that the Romans admitted that, because the Romans are not going to take a live person down from the cross. They're not going to do that. That's not their style. The fact that his body was taken down is further proof that he was dead. This swoon theory is absolute foolishness. Jesus was dead. And Joseph took that body, wrapped it in linen, and placed it in a tomb. And that gives further ability then for some other people to come into the scene, which is Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph and Salome. Remember, they were back there at the crucifixion. They were a distance off watching what was going on. And then they see Jesus being buried. And then they're waiting until the next day. Remember, all this happens on Friday. On the next day of Saturday, after the Sabbath has finished around 6 o'clock in the evening, they want to go buy spices. They're going to prepare to go to Jesus early on the first day of the week. Early in the morning on the first day of the week, they want to go prepare his body with the spices. Now, they're having to do that because they didn't have the embalming technology that we have today. The spices were there to help with the stench and to help with the decaying process. They want to, just as Joseph of Arimathea wanted to show respect to Jesus, they want to show respect to Jesus too. But let me note too, that this wouldn't happen normally for a crucified person. A crucified person, normally as their body's taken out, is just thrown to the side, thrown in a criminal's lot. But not Jesus. No, the body of Jesus is cared for. And as they're going to the tomb, and you can just see these three women, Jewish men at this time were not very big in stature to begin with. Jewish women even smaller. And they're thinking to themselves, how are we going to move this rock? We've got a great plan here, but how are we going to execute this plan? And yet whenever they get there, they see the rocks are removed. And they enter the tomb and they find a young man. And they said, "You're looking for Jesus." He said, "You're looking for Jesus, but he is risen. He is risen." Yet this is what I want you to do. I want you to go to the disciples. And he notes Peter specifically. And I want you to tell them that what I told you back in chapter 14 and verse 28 about meeting me in Galilee after my resurrection, that plan's a go. You need to go make that happen. Yeah, we ought not be too hard on these women, as they are surely in the shock of all shock. And they run away from the tomb, trembling and astonished. And the text ends with them, verse 8 ends with them being afraid. Now, most of our Bibles at this point are going to have some sort of indication that what takes place in from verse 9 on isn't exactly normal with the rest of the text. If you're curious about that, then please consider the bulletin for some more reading on that. But as I noted in the bulletin to listen to in the lesson, here's why I'm okay with the text ending right here. I'm okay with the text ending right here because it ends with something that we've seen so often in Mark's gospel. And that's fear. And the fact that fear, brothers and sisters, brings us the opportunity to make decisions. Jairus was fearful for his daughter's well-being in life whenever she was deathly ill. And that fear led him to a decision, what will I do? He decided to go to Jesus. In that same context, the woman who had the continuous bleeding issue, she feared for her life. She feared that she had nowhere else to go. But she decided at that moment, I'm going to go to Jesus. And when she touches him and Jesus feels it, and he says, "Who touched me?" She's filled with fear again. Oh no, am I in trouble? But she made a decision that moment, I'm going to stand up and say it was me. But then we also have moments in Mark's gospel where the disciples themselves were fearful. How many times were they fearful on the sea whenever Jesus showed his power? His power over the elements. And so many times in this text, they were fearful. And yet instead of being like those previous two examples where they made a positive response to their fear, the disciples themselves shirked away. They cowered away. Their hearts were hardened. Again, brothers and sisters, we are left here, if this text, hypothetically speaking, if Mark ends at verse 8, we are left with what we've seen so many times, fear. And it's an opportunity for these women to decide, what am I going to do with this fear? It's an opportunity for the apostles who have scattered as Jesus said they were going to be scattered, for them to make a decision, what will I do next? And really that leaves us with a decision to make as well, which we'll get to in just a moment. I want to leave us with just a couple of questions for us to consider as we look at this text and think about ourselves from this text. Think about ourselves from the perspective of Barabbas. Do we recognize the Barabbas-like position that we ourselves are in? Remember, the choice here is easy. Who should live? The one who is innocent or the one who is guilty? And yet in this moment, the one who is guilty was released, was freed. And as we're thinking about this text, I hope that so often as we're reading through this text, there are just bells going off in our mind thinking, Isaiah 53, because that's what this text is. As we have here in Mark, a rebel being set free, we read of that very thing in Isaiah chapter 53. In Isaiah 53 in verse number 12, therefore I will give him the many as a portion, and he will receive the mighty as spoil, because he willingly submitted to death. Jesus did not argue his case before the people beside Pilate. He didn't say, I'm innocent, set me free. No, he willingly submitted to death, and he was counted among the rebels. Yet he bore the sin of many, and he interceded for the rebels. Not only did Jesus do it literally there in that moment, very specifically with this rebel, he interceded for this rebel, Barabbas. But we have to recognize that we stand in Barabbas' place as well. Very generally speaking, as Jesus has interceded for us. In that text, brothers and sisters, he took the punishment due us. Because of our sin, we are deserving of punishment. Yet he bore that for us as the Lamb of God. The perfect, sinless Lamb of God. He bore that for us. He interceded for us, the rebels. Do we understand that? And if we do, here's my question to follow up to this. What will we do with that opportunity given to us by Jesus? What will we do with the grace afforded to us by His sacrifice? But here's the second question I want us to consider. Are we willing to be like Jesus, even to suffer as righteous people because of our commitment to God? Remember, he's here not because he's deserving to be here. No, he's here because this was the preordained plan of God. Jesus was here in this moment because it was God's will for him to suffer. Again, Isaiah 53, it pleased him that he was crushed. This was God's plan. And he went through with this plan because he was committed to his Father. Brothers and sisters, are we willing to suffer because we're committed to our Father? Because just as Jesus was surrounded by people who were prideful and who wanted things done their way, are we not surrounded today by people who are prideful and who are not willing to recognize the truth and acknowledge the truth? Certainly we are. What happens whenever they deny truth and we stand with it? Are we willing to suffer as righteous people because of our commitment to God? We look at the example of Jesus. He was, and he was God himself. How much more should we be willing to do so because of his example? Yet, with all these things taken into consideration, our main point for this lesson, what I hope that we'll take not just for this week, but as we consider Mark moving forward anytime we're studying this text, I hope we'll think about this and ask ourselves this all-important question. Who Jesus is and what he has done has led us to a point of decision. We are Mark 16 and verse 8. We acknowledge the empty tomb. We ourselves are even filled with fear Because we recognize the ramifications of our own rebellion and our own sin. We fear the fact that there is an all-knowing, all-powerful God who dwells above us and who will judge us in the end. Here's the question: how will we respond to that? How will we respond to God's servant giving His life for us? How will we respond to that atoning sacrifice? How will we respond to the fact that the tomb is empty and that shows God's power for resurrection? Brothers and sisters, how will we respond? That is the question I leave you with this morning as we conclude our study in Mark's Gospel, this study of this incredible Jesus, not just incredible in His identity, but incredible in every sense concerning what He did during His time on this earth. What will we do with this Jesus?